Hi everyone, Mo here, and welcome to the More Simple Podcast. October is here, and this month we're turning our attention to something deeply important: men's health and prostate cancer awareness. It's a topic that doesn't always get the attention it deserves, but it affects more men and more families than we often realize. So throughout this month, we're creating space for honest, hopeful conversations about men's health. I'll be joined by four incredible guests, two men who have walked through a prostate cancer diagnosis and are now using their stories to help others feel less alone, and two medical professionals who share practical insights on prevention, early detection, and caring for our health as men, brothers, husbands, and fathers. These stories are powerful, eye-opening, and filled with hope. So if there's a man in your life that you love, I encourage you to share this series with him, because awareness truly saves lives. So let's have this conversation together. Now enjoy the show. Welcome back to another episode of the More Simple Podcast, a space for culturally curious, globally minded souls seeking meaning, connection, and the fullness of human experience. Today, I have the incredible honor of hosting a pioneer in the field of psycho-oncology, whose life's work has profoundly shaped how we care for people, not just as patients, but as whole human beings. He's a professor emeritus of clinical psychiatry at the Weill Cornell Medical College and an emeritus attending psychiatrist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, where he has served for over three decades. His clinical and research legacy spans from co-developing the distress thermometer to creating the Memorial Anxiety Scale for Prostate Cancer, MAX-PC, and also conducting impactful research on fatigue, anxiety, and depression in people with cancer. He has spent nearly 30 years as a psychiatric liaison to MSKCC's genitourinary oncology program, helping men with prostate cancer navigate both the physical and emotional terrain of the disease beyond the accolades, of which there are many, including the Lifetime Achievement Awards from both the Society of Liaison Psychiatry and the American Psychosocial Oncology. He's a teacher, a mentor, and a master listener. His work reminds us that medicine is as much about the heart as it is about the body. In today's conversation, we explore the emotional lives of cancer patients, or patients with cancer, sorry, the legacy of psycho-oncology, the psychological impact of prostate cancer on men, and what it means to age, grieve, and heal in a world that often rushes past all three. So everyone, please join me in welcoming Dr. Andrew Roth, who I had the absolute pleasure of meeting at the American Psychosocial Oncology Society Conference this past March in Pittsburgh. Welcome, Andy.
Thank you. It's great to see you again, Mo.
Thank you. And many thanks to Bill for making the introduction. And I'm so thankful that our paths crossed.
Yeah, me too. Hopefully I can live up to the introduction you just gave me. It was very complete and long, and I still remember much of it. but we'll get talking about all of it, and I think it'll be fun.
I always say it's just a slice of your grand life, and so if it's long and rich, it's because you've lived such a rich life as well. So thank you. Can you take us back to the early chapters of your life? What your upbringing was like, and specifically, be able to share the early events that must have predicted what you're currently doing right now?
Great question to start at the start. I think if a fortune teller had predicted, even a few years after I finished undergraduate college, that I would one day become a physician, I would have had a really great laugh. I wasn't, even as an undergrad, willing to take science courses like organic chemistry. I could never understand why anyone would volunteer to take that kind of a course. It seemed everyone was having such trouble and burdens with that. And had someone then said, after I became a physician, that I would one day not only be a physician, but a psychiatrist and a psycho-oncologist, that would have been an even bigger laugh for me, because there is no way to make those kinds of predictions based on my upbringing. And I think all along my career, doors seemed to open up that had new venues for me. And with the right supports, sometimes some people pushing me a little bit into those right doors, I was able to have a really wonderful career. It's interesting because I was a very quiet kid when I was growing up. I came from a working class family that was, both my parents were strong into making sure my older brother and I had a good education. But there were no physicians that I ever knew personally through my childhood. In fact, physicians were always people, you know, to try to avoid.
Avoid,
because that meant, you know, something was wrong and there might be problems and pain. I think, and sometimes, you know, my upbringing, was a relatively happy one, although my parents eventually got divorced. And I think some of that, growing up with this sense of things don't always go the way you want or the way you expect, may have led me at some point to be open to the idea of going through some of the doors of becoming a psychiatrist. My mom loved working. She was a bookkeeper, and she really loved numbers and words and organizing others. And trying to figure out solutions for sometimes problems that seemed unsolvable. I think she would have been a great business leader. In fact, in her 50s, she went back to college to get a degree in journalism. Unfortunately, she got lung cancer in her late 50s, and she died of the lung cancer at age 63. That too, I'm sure there are threads and roots for that pulled me towards oncology. My dad was a factory worker, and he worked in the garment district in Manhattan, and he would cut fabrics, which was a pretty tough job. But unlike my mom, he couldn't wait to retire. And get away from what he described as back-breaking work. But he stayed at the same job for years. I think, you know, he was in combat in World War II and had lots of different illnesses throughout his adulthood, from hearing problems, gastric problems. And eventually he too died of lung cancer 3 years after my mom had died. Now, I imagine anyone who's hearing this biography could probably see, you know, the roadmap for Andy Roth going into medicine and psycho-oncology. Anyone but me. I might have been the last one to figure out this stuff. When I was a kid, I wasn't the best of students. I had strabismus when I was a kid. I had eye surgery. I couldn't read very well. So the academics was often a chore for me. And so it wasn't an easy thought to say, he'll become a doctor or something like that, especially with no role models in my family. Mm-hmm. But again, my parents did stress the importance of education. And so even though I was a shy and quiet kid, people would often say to me, "Cat got your tongue," kind of thing like that, which would just feel more quiet. And, you know, I didn't want to say something that I felt might make me look silly or stupid. And so it was painful at times. But I was sort of a master of one word answers. For me, that I was comfortable with that. But anyone who was listening to me was like, "Oh God, we got to ask another question to get this guy to start talking." My saving grace, I think, socially, was that I was a good athlete, And a good, I was a fast runner. And I even played football one year, tackle football, pop, we call it Pop Warner football. It's local recreational football, where I was a running back. And I got, you know, an award for the most outstanding back. And it wasn't necessarily because I was such a great football player, but I was very fast. And I was even faster when people were chasing me. So make it to the end zone pretty quickly.
You didn't talk much, but you could run fast.
I could run fast, yeah. I couldn't run my mouth, but I could run my legs. And I was a sociology major when I was in college. Again, I didn't take many of the hard science courses. I thought about being a social worker, perhaps, and I decided that I wanted to work on bigger systems problems. Mm. And when I was a student at Brooklyn College, I did my first research study, which actually never got, wasn't a publishable study, but I worked with the, or volunteered with the New York Public Interest Research Group. And we investigated a problem called redlining in Brooklyn, which is where savings banks, which had responsibility to invest local deposits in local neighborhoods, weren't doing that. They weren't giving mortgage money even to creditworthy people. And it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you don't have funds coming in, neighborhoods can't thrive. And so we had documented that the savings banks weren't giving money into the local neighborhoods in Brooklyn. And after I graduated, I became a community organizer. And so all of this is still not leading anywhere into the world of medicine. However, these, I think those roots were very important for me to be able to thrive as a psycho-oncologist and to be a helpful person, both academically as well as clinically and teaching. I think we, in fact, we were so successful with the organizing, we were able to get a couple of New York State and federal laws, passed, the Community Reinvestment Act. And so there was a sense of accomplishment for sure. But it was about a few years into organizing when my mom had gotten sick with her lung cancer. And I thought that, you know, I had this, you know, nice career, though maybe not that well paying, but it was very fulfilling as an organizer. But I was thinking maybe I could be doing something in the world of healthcare. Before I finished the organizer, as I was, as I gave up my commitment to stay there in Brooklyn, I had one of the organizers that I worked with was a VISTA volunteer. And so we started dating after I finished my commitment there, but we eventually got married, and her family, you know, was a very medically oriented family. And there were no shortage of role models in the world of medicine for me there.
For you.
And that was very,
thank you. You've knocked out so many of my questions. So by me asking just that one question about your pathway. So thanks for doing that. Now, as you know, psycho-oncology is a niche area. I think it wasn't until quite recently that was, you know, made even more brought to light by the late Dr. Jimmy Holland. So for those who are not familiar with that field, can you walk us through, you know, how psycho-oncology came to be recognized as an essential part of cancer care, what battles had to be fought quietly or loudly to make space for it?
Well, thank goodness for people like Jimmy Holland, Mary Jane Massey, Marguerite Lederberg, Bill Breitbart. Those are the folks I knew from the Sloan Kettering environment, but there were folks throughout the world of CL psychiatry who saw the importance of taking care of patients and families who were going through cancer crises. And, you know, Jimmy was always suggesting that, you know, the care of the patient was really in caring for the patient and for the family. And I think when she came to Sloan Kettering in the mid-1970s, we were a part of the Department of Neurology, and we were welcomed there. Jimmy set up a small division of psychology there, and they basically started seeing people in the hospital for different kinds of psychiatric issues, medical issues that had psychiatric sequelae. And I think you know, her husband was Jim Holland, who was an oncologist. And I think she felt like, you know, it seems so natural for people to get care for their actual cancer, but who's taking care of the person who has the cancer? And that was the title of one of her books, The Human Side of Cancer.
That's right, yeah.
Which was very important in terms of looking at the person and trying to find and recognize that not everybody who has even the same cancer diagnosis will go through the same kinds of trajectories. And so trying to see how each person, each person from a different culture, the nuances of their particular cancer and their comorbidities medically and psychiatrically, all of that, we couldn't put every person into a mold and say, this is the recipe. We had to figure out how to do this. And Jimmy and the other pioneers had to figure out how to do this in a thoughtful, organized way. And that's, they started using self-report questionnaires.
Nice.
That initially were seen as, you know, this is not scientific. This is just asking a person how they're feeling. But it was those self-reports that really got to the field to have an understanding of how people were coping or not coping well with their cancers. They wanted to get better, but they were having difficult times. Life was not just about longevity. Quality of life became a very important area that was looked at, because we had to be able to figure out not just how to get someone to a 5-year mark or a 10-year mark, but how do they have a better life overall for as long as they're alive.
Wow. And this was in 1970s, right?
This was the 1970s that she got to Sloan Kettering, yeah. I finished my psychiatric residency in 1988, and then went to Sloan Kettering. No, 1992. Then went to Sloan Kettering for my fellowship, for a 2-year fellowship. And I remember one of my attendings in residency could see that I wanted to do well as a physician, I was also kind of an anxious guy, and I'm still kind of an anxious guy, and it doesn't come across to people so easily, but I put it out there, as some supervisors have for me, to be able to try to model that none of us are perfect. We all have our abilities. And because someone is anxious doesn't mean they can't be a good psychiatrist, although that's what a supervisor said to me. Said, you're so anxious. How are you going to be a good psychiatrist? And I thought, maybe I'm in the wrong field. But I think I've had a lot of support and help. And that's as a teacher, as a program director, that's what I wanted to make sure people could have, was a good enough support system, so that people who are human and might have anxieties, even on the physician side,
yeah,
will be able to deal with a very stressful workload and be able to find meaning in their work.
Your work, yeah. And you've hit on a very critical point. Thanks for sharing all of that, by the way. I think given that, you know, anxiety, depression, these are also part of the human experience, right? And having a physician who's so open about their struggle, it also helps to make for a better connection with your patients because you're able to relate to some degree.
That's right. And I think, you know, there's always a question of how much do we share with patients, how to keep up sufficient boundaries. But I think in some ways, not just with feeling anxious, but even having had some medical issues that I do talk about in the prostate book of I had an acoustic neuroma resected maybe 19 years ago. And so I went from being a psychiatrist that I knew all along to how do I be a one-eared psychiatrist? And it wasn't easy, but it was something that I had to adapt to and adjust to. And I think the being in the role of patient for a while, though I wouldn't recommend it for anyone if they don't have to do it. But it did help me, I think, be a bit more empathic and understanding of what my patients were going through.
Thank you for sharing that. Now, to pivot a little bit from that conversation, how do you think the field of psycho-oncology has changed since you started? And what do you hope the next generation holds on to?
I think if I look at a trajectory, the field has been much more scientific than when I first got into it, but I was able to see the growth of the science of the field, which was quite amazing. I'm a bit concerned that, you know, not just with psycho-oncology, but for a lot of medicine, you know, there's a lot of burden for clinicians. Mm-hmm. That's true for nurses. It's not just for physicians, for nurse practitioners, for social workers, you know, hospitals. And I'm not an administrator, certainly not anymore. And I don't understand the workings, but I can't imagine how much of the academics is going to thrive when there's less financial support, as we've seen recently. And so I think, I was quite fortunate with Jimmy and Bill Breitbart making sure that there were funds available for me to do some of my pilot studies. You mentioned the distress thermometer and the MAX-PC, the Memorial Anxiety Scale for prostate cancer. You know, we were dealing with men who, and men are often not the first ones to get in line for a psychiatric evaluation. There's a lot of stigma related to it, but with consult liaison psychiatry, I was embedded in the prostate cancer clinic. So I would go in with the oncologist, and the oncologist would often say, I want you to see Dr. Roth because he's going to help me help you get through this cancer. Men were very worried or anxious about PSA tests, about recurrence of disease. So the anxiety was very high. But we thought if we ask men on a scale, and we called it an anxiety questionnaire or a depression questionnaire, they would just say, no way. you know, I'm not depressed. I'm not anxious. So we used the word distress. We put out the questionnaire, and distress was much more acceptable to the men, and we medicalized it. We made it into a thermometer, so it didn't have the onus of just a psychiatric problem. And then the scale was wonderfully adopted and adapted by the National Comprehensive Cancer Network and the American Cancer Society, and they developed not just the thermometer, but a problem list so that patients could check off what their major issues were, not just a visual analog scale of 0 to 10 on the thermometer. And it would make for easier triage, whether it was psychosocial issues or whether it was spiritual chaplaincy issues or social work issues that we could make referrals to sooner. So we found with the distress thermometer, there was a lot of distress in the clinic. We wanted to try to figure out a bit more of and try to break that down and understand what it was. And so that's when we developed the Memorial Anxiety Scale for prostate cancer. And the base, you know, it has a subscale for fear of recurrence. It's based on the like an impact of events type of scale. And I think it's been used a lot in different kind of research milieus and environments with new treatments to try to understand, you know, what is happening with a man's anxiety. Is it stable, going, getting worse, getting better?
I mean, as someone who's been, because I've been working with prostate men with black men with prostate cancer, that's been my area of research since 2011. You hit on so many things that we see constantly, you know, like test anxiety and just the fear of recurrence. And I'm so glad to hear that, you know, your tools like Distress Thermometer and Max PC, they help to capture that. Now, let's segue a little bit into, you know, cancer. So what would you say are some of the most profound lessons you've learned from working alongside patients and their families?
Profound?
Yes, yeah, especially when it comes to cancer, yeah.
I think in large part recognizing that people are unique. Now, for psychiatrists, that shouldn't be, you know, a big surprise at all. It's not a surprise, but recognizing the uniqueness of patients and providing them with a place where they can express their concerns, their frustrations about treatment, their difficulties with communication, sometimes with staff, sometimes with family, that they had a place to be able to deal with this. And that, you know, that's one of the nice things I think about screening, whether it's with the distress thermometer or another screening tool. It's not so much, yeah, we'd like to see if someone has high anxiety or depression, but it's also a nice first step, an introduction to the cancer environment where you could say, oh, your distress is not that high today, but if it goes up, if you're feeling uncomfortable, we have social workers, we have psychologists, we have psychiatrists, we have other people that you can deal with to help relieve some of that angst or distress or whatever is going on. And so I imagine in most cancer centers, there's always some brochure about what the supports are in a hospital. But when you actually get to put it together with how someone's feeling and you can say, and this is what we have available, I hope there's a little bit of a better uptake when there is a need. I think one of the things that I also learned was that, and this is true for maybe CL psychiatry in general, but it's very true in the cancer setting, is that not everything that looks psychiatric is psychiatric. And that's what I, you know, I had a lot of joy being able to interact with nurses and oncologists and the whole treatment team to be able to understand what was going on medically. That was very important for me, but also to help them understand what might be looking psychiatric, but might have its roots in the medical or some combination of the medical and psychiatry. When I first had heard about CL psychiatry, I was a third year medical student. And when I went to med school, I was going to be an internist for sure, just like my father-in-law. And that didn't work out. I for many reasons, maybe my parents' illnesses had something to do with it, but I think also I went through my first rotation of surgery, and one of the surgeons very supportively noted, "Oh, you have a tremor." Well, Halstead had a tremor, and this is how you deal with it. And I was a little embarrassed, but frankly, it was great information to point out how my hand-eye coordination was being impacted. And though I never became a surgeon, the information he gave me about how to stabilize my hand came in very handy whenever I was using a laser pointer in a lecture, because otherwise, you know, the light was going all over the place. So it was useful information. Then I did my medicine rotation, and I realized that I was not having the kind of connection with patients that I wanted. I was good at figuring out the labs and the tests and the IVs and all that, but I wanted more of a connection with the patients. And that's what I found in my next rotation, which was psychiatry. And especially, there was a day in the week where we used to go and do consults in the medical and surgical areas of the main hospital. Yeah. And to me, that was like a Reese's peanut butter cup. It was the joy of medicine and psychiatry. I said, why? And this could be a career. So that being able to see psychiatry and medicine with those eyes, with those eyeglasses, I think was very helpful for me. And it really shaped how I would teach medical students and residents and fellows.
That's awesome. I love just everything you shared, especially the intergenerational mentoring model of having the younger, you know, the people that are working with you, like the students, just see that side of medicine and being able to help them stay grounded. So thanks for sharing all of that. Mm-hmm. Sure. One of the things that came up from my experience with men with prostate cancer is just that unspoken fear of so many things, especially when they have been diagnosed with prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. And at the time they are working on making decisions around treatment, sometimes it's almost like abandoned. Like the moment they hear they have the C word with cancer, it's like everything freezes up, right? And they rely on the doctors to like make recommendations for them. And then with time, there's a little bit of decisional regret that comes into play, especially if they realize, oh, I shouldn't have done surgery. Perhaps I could have gone for another kind of treatment modality. I guess my question for you with this, for men right now, how can we really support men who might be reluctant to express, you know, vulnerability, especially in the face of something pervasive like cancer?
Well, it's not easy. And I think I probably was one of the few, if only, psychiatrists embedded into a prostate cancer clinic. And when you're part of a clinic, it becomes a lot easier, but not easy, to help men accept that the psychiatry and the medicine are connected. And, you know, it's not unusual for men or for anyone diagnosed with cancer to freak out with a diagnosis. Yeah. Even if people had a family history of cancer and they get the same cancer, until one gets it, one can kind of hope that it's not going to happen, or it's not going to happen anytime soon. And so the window of mortality opens up for anyone, I think, diagnosed with cancer, even for the people who are going to be cured. We just don't know. They just don't know who's going to be cured. And so there's a potential threat of dying. And I don't want people to prepare to die. Although, you know, frankly, even for young people, they say, you know, get a will while you're young, especially if you're having children, get a will and then put it away and live your life. If cancer comes around, I guess I'd want people to, you know, not prepare to die, but be aware of what could happen, make plans, and then get on to living. I think what happens with, even with PSA tests, you know, men are thinking about the next test or the next test. Is it going to go up a little, down a little? And some can be quite obsessed, and not in a pathological kind of way, but they get obsessed with, is it going to go up or down? And they worry, and they get on Google and try to figure out what are the best treatments, the next treatments. And I don't want to say they shouldn't do that, because I think getting some level of information about what's going on is important. But I have seen too many men spend a lot of time on the internet, and it's almost like that's become their lives as opposed to living their lives. And so I'd want them to think about, you know, the more time they're spending thinking about what's going to happen, are they going to be alive in 5 years, in 10 years, in 3 years, whatever it's going to be, the more they're thinking about that, the less I think they're living their lives. And so, you know, we as human beings have the ability to think of many different things at once, contrary things sometimes. I want to live. I'm afraid I'm going to die. But if I think talking with a therapist, it doesn't have to be a psychiatrist, talking with a therapist, a social worker, a psychologist, maybe a even some of the nurses or physicians about what the fears are, you know, I think a validation approach of, yeah, I can understand why you're scared. Cancer is scary. Your dad may have died of cancer. It's not unusual for men whose dads had prostate cancer, for them to get diagnosed at an earlier age, and maybe even with more aggressive cancer than their dads. And then they're feeling like, this isn't fair. Why is this happening to me? And everybody, I think, who gets cancer is asking the why question. Why me? Why now? And as many of my patients said, they would ask that, and at some point they'd say, why not me? This stuff happens to lots of, in the African-American community, it happens to a lot of men, but it doesn't happen to every guy. And so, if it does happen, how do you deal with it and say, how can I make the best decisions
out of this? Yeah.
And this is a tricky thing. I talk about this in the prostate book. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, when treatment plans are provided to patients by the treatment team, or, you know, many men go for two or three or four second opinions. And second opinions can be really helpful, but they can also make things more confusing.
Yeah.
Because in the world of prostate cancer, and with a lot of cancers, you can go see five experts and you may get four different or five opinions. Or six different opinions on what do you do? What do you do first? How do you do this? What are the best tests to be able to analyze this? And so it can be kind of confusing, and it can be kind of frustrating. And so I often would suggest to men that it's okay to have the second opinions. Usually it's better if two people are going in so you can analyze what's going on. And the second person hopefully is someone who is not quite as anxious as you, the patient, might be.
Yeah.
And someone you can trust to hear and to be able to get the information. But most men have a difficult time because they want to get the best treatment. What does the best treatment mean? For a lot of men, it means I want the best outcome, cure, and I want the least amount of side effects. No side effects.
Right.
And there's no way to predict that. And so if someone goes through a treatment and they live for 50 years, a long time, and they have no side effects, we could say that was the right choice. But I might also say that at the time when you couldn't get five experts to agree on what the right choice is, that once you move forward, that is the right choice. There may always be what some of my patients call buyer's remorse. Mm. That, you know, you make a treatment, something doesn't go right, and you say, I should have done this. Why didn't I do that? Why didn't I go to that place? And there is no way of knowing that. Because if there was a way of knowing the right treatment, all five of those experts would have agreed this is the right thing to do. And even then, it doesn't always work out because our bodies are not always, you know, we're not the same. We don't always respond to different medicines or treatments in the same way. Mm. There are a lot of men who say, you know, I was in great shape. I always exercised. I ate well. And look what happened to me. I got this cancer. And they're right. It's, you know, it's not, it may not feel fair. It may not be good. It's not good. However, what I do think is a way of seeing even that situation as a glass half full is that I can only imagine if they were not eating well and they were not exercising and taking care of themselves, mm-hmm. how much worse things could be because they might not get through the treatment, A, or B, that maybe they would have developed some other medical problem before the prostate cancer showed itself. And that would be the focus of their life, heart disease or other kinds of illnesses. So I wouldn't throw out the baby with the bathwater and say, oh, now I have cancer. What's the point of staying in shape? I'd say there's always reason to stay as healthy as we can and to not give up the, you know,
the fight,
their habits.
Those are great words to live by. Thank you. Thank you so much. So much of your work, much of your recent work focuses on older adults with cancer. Mm-hmm. How does aging really, you know, either complicate or even clarify the emotional experience of that, you know, illness?
It's interesting because some people think that older people, they've been through a lot in their lives. If a cancer happens when they're in their 70s or 80s, they can just accept it. Mm-hmm. And I think there is some feeling that older people can cope better with a cancer diagnosis for some of those reasons. But I think when it comes to the emotional reactions of any particular person, it may depend on who they are and what their medical comorbidities are, what their experiences with illnesses and maybe cancers were. Did they know other people who had that cancer? What happened to them? Are they thinking about a grandparent who had the same cancer 40 years ago and had chemotherapy that was, you know, very tough to tolerate? Well, chemotherapy, though it's not easy to tolerate, is much more easily tolerable today than it was 40 years
ago. Yes, correct.
And it can be, you know, we have so many wonderful treatments. You know, they talk about personalized medicine and personalized cancer treatment. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, when you can spot the particulars of someone's cancer and you try to go for those targets, there is a very different science today than there was 40 years ago. And it doesn't guarantee that someone diagnosed today will do well, but I think there's a better shot of doing well. And certainly, you know, there are people who were diagnosed by accident because, you know, they had a scan looking for something and they found a cancer, an early stage cancer. And that's, you know, it's bad to have the cancer, but that if someone's going to get diagnosed, I think that's not the worst way to do it.
Get
it early and get it treated early.
Yeah. I asked that out of curiosity, too, because in my studies, we found just the dynamic with age. So like I said, I work with black men with prostate cancer, and it was a very exploratory study, just looking at their lived experiences. But in teasing out the data, we found out that regardless of where they were from, because we try to control for immigration, like those who were born in the U.S. versus those that came from African or Caribbean countries. We found that age also played a moderating role in how they really perceived the cancer. So, for example, younger men didn't cope as better as older men. So because of the complications from either the diagnosis itself or even like the treatment modalities. So sexual dysfunction, urinary incontinence, and all of that. And then older men who were married to younger women that had younger wives they had a harder time coping because of all the sexual expectations and the guilt of having to, like, you know, give up so many things. So I just thought to ask that because I was curious about that.
Oh, I think your study found some very common and important points, which is it's hard to generalize that just because someone is older, yeah. they're going to be better or worse.
Yeah, yeah.
Particular situation may be important there. How important sexuality has been to a person or to the relationship they're in could be very important. And that's, you know, even they may not have much in the way of sexual side effects, but the concern mm-hmm. of that is there. And certainly if someone has metastatic disease and they're on one of the hormonal treatments, there's a much bigger potential of not just sexual side effects, but fatigue and the hot flashes and other kinds of things that, whether you're old or young, those things are not easy to cope with. And so yeah. being able to hear whether someone is old or young, what their concerns are, what their fears are, or what they're angry about. You know, it wasn't unusual when I would go, when I'd have a new patient come to see me in the clinic, I'd go into the waiting room and I'd say, Mr. So-and-so, mm-hmm. and two people would stand up. The appointment was for just Mr. So-and-so. And so I'd go, I'd get introduced to Mr. So-and-so's partner, and I'd start walking back to the office, and I'd look over my shoulder, and there were two people following me, not just Mr. So-and-so. And I would ask, you know, do you want your partner to come in with you? And he would always say, yes. Yes, that's why I'm here. Yes, mm-hmm. we're in this together. Yes, we have to figure this out. I wouldn't be coming here if it wasn't for them. And so I think that was very helpful to be able to say that, you know, when someone's diagnosed with cancer, there's a lot of control that's taken away from them. If mm-hmm. they control who comes with them into the room, that can be helpful. At some point, I might ask the partner to step outside so we could have some time alone with the patient. But I think giving them some time to develop some confidence that I might be able to help them. I was not going to be, you know, someone who just sat quietly and listened to them and went, uh-huh. Their fears of what a psychiatrist might do. I think that was always very, very helpful.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. I mean, cancer is such a, I mean, just listening in and I'm working with the people I work with, the impact it has on family and just on individuals is so ravaging. But the importance of social support, you know, whether from family or any loved one you're able to, like, have with you cannot be understated. So thanks for sharing that.
Yeah. No, one thing I might want to add also is sure. that with older people, emotionally, especially those who have depression, they may not always present as younger people do. They might have more somatic complaints, more fatigue, more pain issues, rather than saying I'm depressed. And mm-hmm. so trying to tease that out is very important. With patients and being able to hear what the aggravations are, what their psychological history was. This is a moment in time, but they've had a lifetime of dealing with other kinds of maybe traumatic or stressful situations. To see how that measures up, how have they been treated in the past if they've been depressed, or how did they even present? Was it with the complaints of somatic issues? And that's very difficult in someone who has cancer, who's getting cancer treatment, because there may be a lot of somatic side effects, including maybe pain from the cancer or fatigue from the treatment that can make it look as if someone is depressed.
But
where we have to figure out, oh, is this depression or is this
something else? You raised a key thing that we found out from our study. So we used a mixed method at a point. We had administered a quality of life measurement that had different domains. One of the commonly used ones, it had symptoms, emotional, physical functioning, and then specific prostate cancer concerns. And when it came to the emotional domains, most of the men reported, doing okay. But by the time we explored in a qualitative, way and asking questions, because again, going back to the questionnaires, questions about, have you been depressed? They said no. But then in talking to them and following up with a qualitative interview, they would talk about just the blues, the fear of recurrence, they won't call it depression. And these are also Black men and some coming from countries where, like, I'm from Nigeria, and depression isn't something we, openly acknowledge because of so many faith-based contexts that, envelopes that. But I found interesting the discrepancies in how this was scored on the questionnaire versus when you talk to them in the during the interview. So we had to report that. Perhaps the skills would need to be culturally tailored to a specific population, because we're asking men about depression. They might say no, but because, they don't think that is depression. But when you define it and, they say something else. Yeah.
I had a family member when I became a psychiatrist. He said he'd never seen a psychiatrist. He was an older gentleman. And he said, so what does a psychiatrist do? And I said, I take care of people who have anxiety or depression. And he said, what's anxiety? What's depression? Now, this was someone who, I don't know what he felt inside about being anxious. I was much younger and I wouldn't ask him, but he smoked a lot of cigarettes. I don't know if that was part of anxiety or just habitual, but if someone hasn't had a contact with the psychiatric field, it can be scary, especially if they've gone 70 or 80 years without seeing a psychiatrist for whatever reason. Maybe they needed it and didn't want to. Maybe they couldn't afford to see one. Maybe it was just too embarrassing to see a mental health expert. And so, again, to try to, I don't know if we can normalize it, but to validate that, yeah, it's scary, and that this doesn't mean that, as Jimmy used to say, patients would be saying something like, for first you tell me I have cancer, and now you want me to see a psychiatrist because you think I'm crazy, as if they've lost all sense of who they are. Mm. And she would say, no, it's not about that. It's how do we help you cope with this stuff? Mm. How do we help you have as good a life as you can while you're dealing with this cancer and looking into the future, but not just looking at it as if you're waiting to die, but how do you live until it is that time that all of us are going to die?
Thank you. As we kind of like winding down this conversation, I was going to ask about your book. So you've written a couple of books. Congrats on all of that achievement, by the way. But your book, the one I have, Managing Prostate Cancer, goes far beyond clinical advice, right? I would like to know what your vision for the book was, and if a newly diagnosed man or his loved one were to pick up the book today, what's one message or chapter you want them to hold on to the most?
I'm not sure about a particular chapter, but of the feedback that I've gotten from a lot of men who read the book and liked it was a recognition that they're not the only ones who are experiencing the emotional concerns that they have. A lot of men think, why I can handle anything. Why can't I handle this? Why am I feeling this kind of dread or anxiety or anger? And who am I going to get angry at. It's not very clear. Am I angry at God for having, you know, this cancer happen? Am I, you know, and that may be for someone who has faith. It may be for someone who used to have faith. And so we find ways, you mentioned the supports for people. How do we find this kind of supports that may be in someone's arena that they may not be thinking of in the moment? And I think that's part of what I've tried to help men figure out how to deal with.
Thank you. And then what do you wish more people, especially men, understood about what it means to live better with prostate cancer beyond just surviving?
That's very individual. I couldn't say what living better is for anybody else except for myself. And living better doesn't always mean that moment to moment I'm living well or I'm living happy. I'd say, you know, to try to take away some of the expectations that we all should be happy, we all should have meaning all of the time. How do we find times to connect with ourselves and with the people who are important to us so that we might find more of those meaningful times? There are men who might have more advanced disease and they stop wanting to see family, their grandchildren, because they don't have the energy or they're having too much pain. And they're used to getting on the floor and playing with them, and now they don't feel like they can do that. So they stop going. And I'd say, you know, it's okay to carve out small amounts of time. Mm-hmm. And the men who are more depressed are usually ones who say, nah, I don't want to do that. The ones who are less depressed but frustrated by the pain, they get excited. They get excited by being with family. They feel a sense of connection. And I guess one of the important sections of the book is where I talk about role modeling. And I'm not sure that, you know, this is on the top of anyone's, oh, I want to do that in life. Although I think maybe many men want to think of themselves as role models. And if they're feeling at any point of having cancer that, you know, gee, I'm kind of weak. How can I be a role model? I'm having this pain. I don't feel like going to a concert. How could I be a role model? And I think that may be the most important types of role modeling that any of us can do. Our children, our grandchildren, I believe are all going to face challenges in life. And when I could look at someone who's going through a challenge, and they say, not that it's not important, but you know what? It's important for me to try to get this treated. It's important for me to maintain some of my value, which is family is very important to me. I want to see my grandchildren grow. I want to be a part of family. If I don't feel like I can sit for an hour and a half at a concert, maybe I decide I go for half of a concert. Yeah. Some guys would say, boy, I'm going to be wasting a lot of money. I'd say, but you're going to be gaining a lot by going to a concert. And even half of that concert, and you might enjoy it. And if they do enjoy that, and I've seen patients, not just men, women with other cancers, they go to the ballet, even for some of it, where they thought, oh, I can't go because it just won't work out. And so they shut it off, as opposed to taking a bit of a risk that it might work out and enjoying it. And so that role modeling for others, I think is I found to be a very helpful tool as a reason to find I still have usefulness, even if I'm feeling weak, even if I am not who I used to be, even if I have pain and I can't do what I'd like to be doing, but I can do some things and I can show you that here's what I would be, you know, wanting to get across, that certain things in life are valued and are important throughout life.
Thank you. And I feel like whether, you know, struggling with cancer or not, those are great words to even live by, you know, for those who might have, you know, either being good health or not so good health. So thanks for sharing that. So you and I met at APOS, which is the America Sex Social Oncology Society, which has become a vital space for community and dialogue in psycho-oncology. What does APOS represent to you personally, and how do you think it has helped you, how has it helped to shape the growth of, you know, psychosocial psycho-oncology field and the next generation of psycho-oncologists?
I think APOS has done a great job of pulling a lot of people from different specialties, taking care of folks who have cancer together. And that's from the psychosocial sides of social workers and nurses and psychologists and psychiatrists, but also primary care doctors. And we have some oncologists who come and some chaplains who come and physical therapists and others who are involved in the treatment of patients. And we can all share and learn from each other. I think that's been a tremendous benefit of APOS. For me, it's sort of been like one of my homes, where I even having retired a couple years ago, I can go to APOS and I see people I've seen through much of my career, and I see some junior people who I never met before, like you, and to for me to feel hopeful about where psycho-oncology is going and where APOS is going, because yeah. I think it does take a village of practitioners who are going to be able to help those who with cancer and their families deal with it.
Yeah. All right, closing questions. Thank you for that, by the way. Thanks. how after such a whole career, how do you define legacy?
Like a lot of other things in my life, I'm not sure I can put a definition on it, because we live moment to moment and things change. I'm grateful that I've been able to write some books. I'm grateful that I was able to get an R01 and do a study on treating men with prostate cancer with psychopharmacology, with psychostimulants to help fatigue. I'm grateful very much for the colleagues that I've had, and I sort of colleagues who I've learned from in the world of medicine, surgery, and psychiatry, and psychology, and social work, and nursing. I've learned a ton, and I hope that I've been able to teach them so that, you know, it's like the butterfly that flaps its wings, and it has impacts that I will never know on people's lives into the future. But I've been really proud that I was able to train as many people at Sloan when I was a fellowship director, but even before I was a fellowship director, and even afterwards. I think, you know, every situation that I came upon, whether it was in the hospital or in the clinic, had an opportunity for some learning and for some teaching, learning for me, teaching and camaraderie and, you know, support. And I thought that CL psychiatry and psycho-oncology, that was made perhaps the most important thing. Yes, it was very important that I was able to take care of patients and their families, but being able to support the people, the doctors and the nurses who were taking care of those patients, was also, I think, a very important part of legacy. In fact, I miss a lot of what I used to do. That's one of them, being able to be there with and for colleagues, as well as the patients and family.
Thanks for sharing all of that beautiful plan. And what brings you joy these days? How do you feel that aspect of your life, given what's happening around the world? And there's so much to talk about that.
Again, you know, joy is, it comes and it goes. If I expected to feel joyful all the time, I guess there are some people who can do that. I've never been that kind of a person. And so when I find myself in a bit of a rut, I might make a conscious attempt to do something that is that I hope will be pleasurable. I meditate every day. I exercise just about every day. I'm learning how to play piano. I play guitar some. I write songs every now and then. I'm taking a Tai Chi class. I'm doing a lot of things that, you know, I could be doing them and then they may not be joyful, but I find that those things are very helpful. That's for me individually. What I also find joy from, and maybe especially, is family. My family, and being able to either speak with them by phone or see them in person, and that brings me joy. That's probably the most slam dunk of joy.
Yeah,
being able to be with my family.
That's great. That's great. Now, do you have kids?
I have two children. I have a daughter and a son, both in their 30s. One of them is a social worker, and one of them is finishing third year of med school.
Oh, wow. That must be very, amazing. And congrats on all of that.
Thanks.
Do they know what they want to do as far as specialty-wise?
My daughter, I think, wants to work with kids. So she's doing pediatric social work. My son, I think he might go into pediatrics also, which is what my wife does. She's a pediatrician. I think they'll have a psychosocial aspect to whatever they do. I know they do, but I'm not sure if there's a psychiatrist in the future.
Well, I'm sure they'll figure it out like you did. You know, despite, like you said, not having a background with your love doctors, but your wife's family was a great inspiration for that. Yeah. And then lastly would be this. If you could leave our listeners with one message, especially those who might be caregivers, clinicians, or simply humans navigating life's messiness, what would it be?
Take care of yourselves. It's very hard to take care of others if you're not able to take care of yourselves. And sometimes that means asking for help, and it's okay to ask for help. And this is probably true for patients too. I think people don't feel like it's okay to ask for help, though they may be the first ones. If someone asks them for help, they're the first ones there to be there to help. But for themselves, it brings up a sense of weakness or a sense of maybe even embarrassment that they can't do it. And if it can be seen as this is part of a human condition as opposed to my condition, it may be part of that role modeling that I talked about earlier, that it's okay to ask for help. It's important to take care of yourself given where you are at right now and do as much as you can right now. And that means taking into account limitations, and grieving, therefore, for things that I might not be able to do anymore. That I, you know, I retired and I thought, you know, oh, now I'll be able to do so many. There are some things that I thought I'd want to do when I was in my 30s and 40s that I can't do now. I'm just too old for that. And so I have to figure out some reasonable things to do now. And I'm doing that. Being aware of what is important now, as opposed to what I think I should be doing, or I think other people think I should be doing. I do definitely want to take into consideration what others need me to be doing, or want me to be doing, but also what is feasible. Seeing a glass as half full has always been an important mantra for me in talking with my patients. Being able, you know, getting someone to do something is better than nothing when it comes to exercise or spending time with a spouse or with family. I think, you know, giving some, I don't think it's quite forgiveness, but giving us a lot of leeway, that we don't have to be perfect. And the older we get, we may be even less and less perfect. But that doesn't mean there's not a reason to still be alive and to enjoy life.
Thank you so much. I'm done with all of my questions. Now, this is the part I just give you a bit of time to maybe summarize whatever else you would like to add to the conversation. But if we're done, I can just do an outro and have you.
I think you covered a lot of ground. We covered a lot of ground.
I think so too.
I don't think there's a, you know, it's sort of against my grain to say, oh, I can sum up life in three sentences. And so I hope that people found the discussion that we had helpful and useful.
Yeah. I just want to say thank you. Thank you so much for your time on the podcast today. And it was really nice hearing from you. And you have done a lot of work in just helping not just patients, but caregivers and loved ones really understand the emotional aspect of cancer, right? And thank you for this remarkable conversation and all of the decades of work you've poured into the lives of patients, families, clinicians, and the entire field of psycho-oncology. Your career, I think, stands as a powerful example of what it means to combine scientific rigor with deep compassion and human connection. So I'm very grateful for your wisdom, your honesty, and your example of living a life of purpose, even in the face of life's hardest moment. It's been an honor to have you on the podcast today. And thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you for asking me. And thank you for all of your hard work putting this all together. And in the midst of juggling so many things in your life, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Rath. To our listeners, we hope this conversation leaves you as it has left me reflecting not only on the science of cancer care, but on the art of healing, listening, and simply showing up for others. And if you're still trying to figure out life, you know, like Dr. Roth, just keep going, even if you don't see the forest for the trees. And you never know, just looking back, the kind of legacy you'll have left behind and the people you'll have inspired as well. So don't give up on that. And have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you. All right. Bye. Thank you.